drink and I know things. That's what I do. I drink and I know things.
Happy Wine Wednesday, everyone. Welcome to How Many More Wine, a podcast about shit we like and shit we don't like. This is Jocelyn, and with me is my lovely co-host, Christine.
How you doing?
Okay, so you're like in full, do I need to get you some gabagool?
Forget about it.
So guys, I don't know if you've picked up on the hint, but we are back with another episode in our special series, The Pilot Project. And this week, we are heading to Northern New Jersey for the pilot of the HBO series, The Sopranos. But first, Christine, what are you drinking this week?
I don't know if it's obvious or not, but I may or may not have been pre-gaming before our recording. So I brewed myself a lovely cup of Panamanian coffee from the David region. And of course, I added to it Allen's coffee flavored brandy.
Oh, my God. I love it.
As an homage to my friend Jessie Lee, who is from the great state of Maine. Her daughter Issa is celebrating her third birthday this weekend. And I thought I would have some Maine-ness to my morning. And have some of the state drink, which is basically coffee-flavored brandy, which is the fucking bomb. I fucking love this thing. It's great. It's from Allen's, and I highly recommend y'all add it to your bar. But beyond what I'm drinking, I have also come to spread the good news, y'all. Yes, I'm here proselytizing for Deep River Snacks. And no, they are not sponsoring this pod. Neither is Allen's. They should, because the amount of people I have told about these fucking transformative potato chips, I should get stock. I should get all types of residuals. Like, it's ridiculous. So Deep River Snacks produces the best fucking potato chip I've ever had in my entire life. I ordered an entire box.
Wow.
And yes, I had a bag for breakfast. And the flavor of chip.
I saw truffle.
Black truffle. Child, I'm telling you, these chips are transformative. I literally went into my boss's office with two crusty old chips at the bottom of the bag and was like, listen, you need to know about these chips. And she's like, oh, I'm a salt and vinegar girl. Ain't nobody gonna get me all salt and vinegar. I said, turn this bag upside down and eat the crumbs in this fucking bag.
God.
And she did. And she did. And she literally started screaming in the office. We also do kudos at the end of like big meetings. And she gave me a kudos for introducing her to these chips in front of like the entire senior team. That's how serious these fucking chips are, y'all. I'm telling you, I want to help you live your best lives. And these chips will completely up the level of your existence on this mortal plane. I promise you.
I promise you. Just found them on Amazon. My cart, and I will finish this purchase later. But okay, you had me at truffle.
I literally bought a box of these fucking things so I could give them away as gifts. Like, that's how good these chips are.
Oh my God. Okay, I am ready. I need to try these. I love black truffle, so, and I trust your judgment in food. So y'all, if Christine is saying that it's good and she's trying to put you on, highly suggest that you take the recommendation and run with it. She's not going to lead you astray.
Never. Not when it comes to food, y'all. I promise.
So I love that you're drinking this week. Yesterday, Podcast in Color did their like once a month they do a thing where they promote podcasts. So I'd like, you know, you have to post a story on IG, and I put in like an excerpt of Beyonce's 7-Eleven about like, don't you drop that alcohol because we are the More Wine podcast. But then it occurred to me, I'm like, I can't remember the last time I've actually had an adult beverage. So I figured that this week was a good time as we venture into Northern New Jersey. So I have, you know, I love my strawberry lemonade orange juice concoction. So I made that and I put a nice shot of lime vodka in it. So it's delicious. I'm enjoying it. And and hopefully we won't be both three sheets to the wind by the end of this discussion. But it's just a tiny little shot, so I'm sure it's not going to be a big deal.
Are we saying hopefully? But listen, I am so excited to hear this because this means this is also a massive development in your recovery. So I am super excited for you that you get to drink again.
And able to drink again in moderation, which is, you know, which was
the way you should drink.
Yeah. Yeah. So
theoretically.
Nice. Yes, exactly. Exactly. But it's nice to
we don't talk about the word theoretically.
Theoretically speaking. Exactly. But it's nice to be able to like have a drink and not feel like I'm going to just start bleeding internally anymore. So that's always
right. Right. Yeah. Let's not do that.
Yes.
Your liver will thank you.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So, all right, before we get into sort of the specifics of the pilot, I love that David Chase was just like, fuck it. The name of the episode is Pilot. I'm not even giving you like razzle dazzle. It's the pilot. We're going to call this fucking the pilot and y'all will just fucking deal with it. But before we get into our thoughts about that specifically, Christine, what was your prior exposure to this series?
Okay, so it's the fucking Sopranos, right? So, like, it's on HBO. I would run into it on occasion. It was in the ether. People were always fucking talking about it. So, what I knew about the show was that it was about the head of a crime family who was constantly stressed about both his family and his job.
Mm-hmm.
That's, like, pretty much what I knew. And then, of course, everybody was talking about the ending.
Yes.
For the longest. And I was working on the 2008 Clinton campaign, which used the ending in an ad. So, like,
oh
The
God.
Sopranos, for me, is mostly about the ending. You know what I mean? I've seen the ending. I know how the show ends. I had no idea how the show began until we did this. But I've seen like the last 4.5 minutes or whatever of the entire series.
Interesting.
And that's what I know about the show.
Okay. So I love that. I love this whole premise when we do these pilots and you haven't seen them. So I'm really excited to hear what you have to say. As for me, I watched the series in real time. Sopranos was a part of like appointment television viewing. It's part of this like long legacy of like Sunday night HBO tradition of appointment television. You know, I think for me, it might have started with like Oz. And then, of course, there was The Wire, Sopranos, Boardwalk Empire, and of course, Game of Thrones.
Sex and the City.
Yes, yeah, Sex and the City, also part of that tradition. So I like the series a lot. It's like one of the best for me. I don't know if it's top 5, but it's definitely top 10 or 15. It's dark, but they do humor really well at the most unexpected times. And it's always really dark humor. But there are aspects of it like racism, misogyny, homosexuality that I think were very much like of the time. I mean, this is a series that started in 1999 and probably a good reflection of how like people in a crime family would probably think about these issues and how they would behave. But I'm not sure, you know, we have our like series, does it hold up? I'm not sure if certain aspects of the show surrounding those issues would necessarily hold up today. I think people are more aware and more conscientious. And this would have definitely been like a discourse generator had Twitter
yes.
been in wide use at the time, for sure. And as Christine noted, like, y'all think Game of Thrones had a controversial ending? Baby, they ain't got nothing on the fucking Sopranos. So, like, the finale aired in 2007, which was, like, just 1 year after Twitter started. And so, like, obviously, you know, there was no live tweeting for me. There was no, like, place to go and see how people were responding. So I just remember, like, having, like, a series of conversations with family members, friends. Like, that night, like, as soon as it finished, it was, like, just calling and making the rounds. Like, what the fuck? Can you believe this? What the fuck? What the fuck? And, like, I remember the radio stations were talking about it the next day and that it was all over, like, any television show that covered pop culture. They were talking about this very controversial ending. And it's just one of those things, like, there was no in between. You either loved it or you hated it. There was no sort of middle ground. So that's sort of the imprint that the series has left with me all these years later. I do try to revisit it every now and then because it's just a really good series. I mean, it's well written. And I think that Tony Soprano is just one of the most interestingly complicated characters I've ever watched. And obviously, James Gandolfini is brilliant in the role. And it's really unfortunate that he died early, because I would have loved to see more of his work because he's such a good actor. But anyway, Christine, what are your overall thoughts about the pilot? What was the shit that you liked?
I mean, I like the fact that they set up the premise of the show really well mm-hmm. in the pilot. At least I'm assuming that this is the crux of it. Homeboy is stressed out about his family. He's stressed out about the changing world of his work and staying relevant and on top. Because as we know, yeah. in his line of work, if you can't maintain power, you die. Right. You know, I'm thinking about Cersei's famous line about the Game of Thrones, right? So I'm feeling like he's a modern crime boss, mm-hmm. maybe a little bit, because he goes to therapy and he's trying to like straddle the old world and the new world. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's a really fascinating angle of the classic mob story. So it's a little, I found it refreshing, right? Like, how do all of these different generations of a crime family work together as their worlds are shifting, right? Mm-hmm. So I appreciated that. One thing I thought was interesting from jump is that there's a will they, won't they vibe with the therapist, right? Like right, you always right. need that type of sexual tension in a show, and it's right there from the very fucking beginning. And I love that. I thought some of the lighting choices were also exquisite. Like that scene in the strip club, all I could think about was the fucking lighting. Like yes. I couldn't even really concentrate on what they were saying. I was just like, oh, this is beautiful. This is almost like a Queen cover. Yes. You know what I mean? Yes. Like with the faces beautifully lit with the black backdrop. It just looked gorgeous. And the last point I'll raise about some of the shit that I liked about the pilot is something that you brought up. And this episode was fucking hilarious. Yes. It's such a serious drama, but it made me laugh. And, you know, you talking about the dark drama, I'm like, well, this is probably my kind of humor, you yeah. know? So, I mean, I have been thinking about that wrapped up corpse falling on the side of the dumpster. I think about that scene all the time now. I think one of my favorite scenes, one of my favorite moments mm-hmm. was Tony right after he fucking chased that gambler down on that campus with the car, and he hit him and he gets out and he goes, "You all
right?" Right. Yes. Yes. Yes.
Like the bone is coming out of his leg and he goes, "You all right?" And, you know, you touched upon the racism in the show, and there was, you know, some xenophobia demonstrated mm-hmm. in this episode. I don't know what it says about me, but I found it a little funny. Like, so I actually had to pause the episode because they were talking about these Czechoslovakians, but they kept calling them Polaks. And yes. I was like, wait, are we talking about the same people? I literally had to stop and rewind. And I was just like, oh, no, this is just xenophobia and racism at play. And I actually laughed a little bit because they were just like, whatever, you know, they're like Eastern European people. They're all the same. They're all Polaks, right?
Yeah.
And then there was some of the generational humor, like mm-hmm. Christopher calling Luca Brasi Lewis.
Like Christopher, totally please. Like, what the fuck?
What the fuck? And I died with the whole, like, big pussy, little pussy conversation.
And when the news report comes on the television and they like and go they through the trouble it. Of right. being like little pussy Malanga, not big pussy Bumpin' Sarah. It's like, right. oh my God.
You gotta keep them straight. But when Tony was like, "You think he'd fuck with my pussy?
Big pussy?" Yes. Yes. That was hilarious.
Oh, my God. I also laughed during the scene, the second scene that they had with the gambler. And he's in his cast and he's all hobbling and shit. Mm-hmm. They went and they got ice cream. I had to laugh because it was such a calm conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they were just like, hey, let's talk like two rational men. Kind of like what Rick was looking for when he was talking to Merle's brother after he done locked up Merle's brother and left him on a fucking roof and shit. He's like, can we talk about this calmly? These three men were actually having a very calm, like almost a heart to heart, you know, talking about antidepressants and all this shit and medication and blah, blah, blah. But the entire conversation is a threat.
It's a threat. Yes. Yes.
And they didn't even need to say it.
No. Nope.
And just he knew as soon as that ice cream truck pulled away and the kids ran off and he just realized, oh, wait, I'm by myself with two mobsters by a fucking waterfall and I'm standing on a bridge. Like, oh.
Yes.
And you don't even need to say anything. It was so good. And I thought it was hilarious. Absolutely hilarious. So yeah, this show is funny as fuck. And I was not expecting that.
Yes. And I'm glad that you mentioned Christopher, because I think throughout the course of this series, Christopher is usually the one that's involved in some of the more comedic scenes. Like there is an episode later in the series where they do an intervention. And my God, I've never laughed harder at an episode. And it's like, you know, an intervention is supposed to be serious. Someone has a problem, but it kind of turns into like Festivus, where people are just like airing their grievances and then people get to fighting at the intervention. Like it is a hot mess, but it is so fucking funny. I'm glad that you love that about it. And like to the point about like the xenophobia, the one thing I do like about The Sopranos is that there's a whole episode about Columbus Day, and you've probably seen like the memes from it because they're all over the internet. And it's really great because it's like they're also sort of looking inward. Like we're Italians, and they explore sort of that attachment of Italians to Columbus as a hero. And it is just, it is such, it's intentionally funny, but from the character's perspective, it is unintentionally hilarious. So I also really like that episode. That might be like season one or season two. It's pretty early on, but I do highly recommend the Columbus episode if you're, you know, picking and choosing other episodes that you might want to watch. I completely agree with you. Like, I think the pilot, David Chase, does a really good job at sort of the world building. You know, it's an hour and it's a tight hour. Mm-hmm. And by the end, mm-hmm. you know, you have this sense of Tony's complicated family life, his relationships, the tension within the crime family as he's getting more established and having to like contend with Uncle Junior, who clearly isn't ready to, you know, be passed over in favor of Tony. And it's also a misdirect. And it's one of the things that's different in the pilot versus the rest of the series. It's almost implicated that like Tony might be the head of the family, but you learn like in subsequent episodes, it's this man named Jackie Aprile, who's actually the head of the family. And you do get introduced to him, but you know, it does ultimately like end up in this competition between Tony and Uncle Junior. So I think they do a good job at foreshadowing that. Another thing that I liked was the use of Tony as a narrator. I think that it helped us really get acquainted with him in a very efficient manner. I loved sort of like the confidence and the bravado that he uses with his interactions with others and how it's like at complete odds with how he's thinking internally. Like one of the things that always takes me out is when he's telling us about Uncle Junior and he's saying, yeah, when I was younger, he made this comment about how I was never going to be a varsity athlete. And it's like, dude, you are a grown ass man. How are you still holding on to this pain? It's your big fucking age. Like the insecurities and what we know about Tony's panic attacks, you know, they felt like something I hadn't experienced before in a show, especially like a show that's about the mafia. So I loved sort of getting into his headspace. And although not like unique, I love to anything about the mafia. I love how like the women in his life are all ball busters. And you know, like you get a taste of it from each And every one of them, by the end of the episode, whether it's Carmela telling that dude he going to hell while he's getting like a head scan, or Dr. Melfi just very quietly like clocking his bullshit. And then, of course, his mom, the biggest ball buster of them all. Like, it is so entertaining. And I love that it's just like this preview into what's to come in terms of Tony and his struggle with dealing with and managing these very like strong-willed women in his life. So that's sort of the high-level overview for me. All right, Christine. So listen, we're on the same page. It's an excellent pilot, but there's always room for improvement. So what were some of the things that you didn't love about the pilot episode?
I'm gonna keep it a buck. I wonder if they kept the name pilot because they didn't make the actors try that hard with the acting. They were just like, we're going to do this. We're going to send this to HBO, see if they like it. Mm-hmm. And then they just ran with it because some of the acting beats were just horrendous. I hope Michael Imperioli gets some acting lessons while he's on the show because he was terrible in the pilot. He was so bad. Meadow was like, I could not listen to Meadow. There was, and I love watching her relationship with her family because it's a very relatable age, you know? And she's far more rebellious than I was at that age. So I kind of like seeing those characters to kind of see the kind of life that I could have lived had I been a bit more, you know, ballsy. But her acting was just so bad in this episode. And I got to say, I don't know if this is a bias with me and that I need to work on, and I'll, you know, write it down and flag it for my therapist this week. But there's something about Italian male actors and crying that I just do not find believable.
Oh, that crying scene with James Gandolfini was terrible. It was not good.
But I, you know, De Niro, anytime he cries on screen, I'm like, nah, you need to talk to your acting coach about this because it's not working for me. Like, there are just so many times when I see Italian male actors cry and I'm like, what is going on here that y'all can't cry in a believable way? You know, I feel like Stabler might be the only one that I believe.
Oh, Maloney. Chris Maloney. Yeah.
He's good. But there's something about it where I'm just like, this is, just skip this. Do a little lip tremble and move on because the crying is not working.
So it's interesting that I completely agree. Like, it's sort of like the crying I complained about in our last episode about The Walking Dead. It just completely takes you out of the moment. And I should have looked into it, but I didn't. But there were moments when he was crying where I wondered, like, is he crying terribly on purpose because he's trying to, like, he's obviously putting on this entire, like, you know, facade for Dr. Melfi. And so I'm like, is the crying terrible because the tears are forced, or is just the crying just like really terrible? But I think they were supposed to be genuine tears because it was about the ducks. Okay. And one of the themes throughout the entire series is his affection for animals and how he absolutely loves animals more than he values people. So he's an awful person. but it did make me sort of like, so that sort of, I sort of, I guess, weighed in on the side of, this is actually supposed to be crying. It's not part of, you know, the act and the facade that he's putting on.
Let me just say one thing though, that I just want to flag. I didn't think all of the acting was horrendous because there was this one moment that I thought was actually absolutely brilliant. And that's Tony reacting to Christopher being like, you know, you could have said I did a good job on the Triborough thing or whatever. I can't remember which bridge he was talking about. Maybe it was Triborough or something.
No, it was a Triborough. You're right.
and Tony is just standing there like facially reacting to what he's saying. So you could see the thoughts running through his head, like, this fucking little prick. Like, he wants to beat the shit out of Christopher. But then he's like, yeah, you know, I'm parenting you the same way I was parented. And that's fucked up. You know, he's trying to break the cycle. But that, watching his facial reaction to that was just so good. I got everything he was trying to deliver in that moment. I thought it was brilliant. That was episode two acting. That's knowing we're going to do a series here and shit. That was beyond pilot acting there.
Yeah. I mean, Gandolfini is one of the best. I mean, the commitment, like he gained 60 pounds to do this role. I mean, he was all in on Tony Soprano. I think maybe even to like the detriment of his
health
and his mental well-being. I think very similar to like Michael K. Williams, just sort of that deep dive, just so deeply engrossed in the character. So I completely agree. That crying was a lot to deal with. I love Michael Imperioli, but okay, so I'm going on a tangent, but he had this show on ABC called Detroit 187, and I watched it because I love Michael Imperioli. And I don't know if the acting gets better. I think that's just him. But the one thing that used to kill me in that Detroit 187 show is that, like, so it's a crime show. He was a detective. And, like, you know, someone comes in and they've got, like, a smoking gun. And he would just do this weird thing with his eyes. It's like, you know, there's, like, no reaction. But it's just like, like, he's, like, trying to tell you. He's trying to show you with his eyes that he's, like, taking the moment in and thinking about it. But he just looks crazed. And he does it all of the time throughout the course of that series. I loved it. It was like a one season and done. But like, I could just watch him do the crazy eyes for hours because I'm like, dude, why has nobody reined this in? Like, it is unintentionally hilarious. So, you know, it's like The Walking Dead. I think it's one of the better pilots that's out there. So it does feel like a little bit nitpicking for me. But I think that David Chase does such a good job with subtlety throughout the course of this pilot that there are moments to me that are just completely not subtle whatsoever that I don't appreciate. So there is the scene where they're all sitting outside of the butcher shop and like, you know, it's shot from like this weird angle. But of course, there's a table with Tony and he's kind of holding court with all of his capos and his trusted friends. And then you have like Christopher sitting way off to the side, like alone, by himself, isolated. He's trying to weigh in and sort of help. I'm like, you've already done such a good job at showing us that Christopher wants to be a made man, that Christopher, you know, is trying to sort of make his mark. I don't know that we like needed that whole, that artsy fartsy kind of setup of that scene to like reinforce the point. It's like, let the writing stand on its own. We didn't really need it to be set up like that. It just felt a little bit too like, you're trying too hard and it's a little bit on the nose. And it kind of took me out of that moment, you know, in the conversation they're having, which is, you know, a really significant one at the time. So that's the one thing that I just didn't love about the pilot. I was hard pressed to find something that I didn't enjoy.
Yeah.
I'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the pilot. Like, Woke Up This Morning by the British band A3 is just one of those like iconic pilot songs. If you look at rankings, it always ranks at least in the top 10. So I'd like to just give it a moment and talk about it. What did you think about this song choice for this series, or, you know, what you know about it having seen the pilot and the last 4 minutes of the finale?
I mean, okay, so yes, I've seen the last 4 minutes of the finale, but I was also still alive and like conscious during the time of The Sopranos. So I knew the theme song, you know, like I press play on the pilot and I'm like, woke up this morning, got yourself a gun. Like, everybody knows this fucking song. You don't have to watch The Sopranos to know it. And yes, it was probably the theme song of an entire decade. You know, like everybody knew this song and it didn't matter whether you were watching the show or not. It's part of my it's in the recesses of my brain quite comfortably.
Yeah. No,
I love it. It's a good song.
It is everywhere. I agree. It perfectly suited the show. It's iconic. It's memorable. If you hear it, there's no way that you think of anything other than Sopranos. I was curious about like how the band A3 feels about that, because I'm sure they've got like a larger body of work, but this is the thing that they'll always be known for better or worse. And they're probably like, guys, check out our other songs. And people are like, no, just play Woke Up This Morning on loop. We want to hear Woke Up, because that's how I would be. Like, you know what we came here for, buddies. I don't want to hear the B-sides. I want to hear on a constant loop, Woke Up This Morning. And I also like how it plays with the visuals from the opening credits. You know, we were talking about how this is like a New Jersey show. So I love how like it opens up with him leaving New York and heading into New Jersey, just letting you know that New Jersey is the star here. Like, no disrespect to New York. And New York does certainly play a part in the series as it progresses, but it's like they're really establishing that this is a show about a mafia family based in New Jersey. Get into it. And I like sort of the, I think that the opening credits along with the music do a good job at sort of laying the groundwork for all of the tension in Tony's life. So he's coming from New York, presumably having done work with probably one of the families in New York. But by the end, you know, he's at home and he's in his driveway with the paper. And so I love how it's just sort of this preview in terms of what the series is going to ultimately be about. And it's as much about his family and his home life in New Jersey as it is, you know, him being a mafia boss and dealing with all of these other people in New York and elsewhere. So it's just perfect. It's a perfect opening. I love it. There are few songs that I like more, although The Wire is Down in the Hole is iconic, and I loved how they changed it up every season. And there's not too many that I think are better than that, but Woke Up This Morning is absolutely up there and deserves all of its flowers, as the young folks like to say.
I definitely made sure to watch the credits. Because, you know, there's always that option now to skip whether you're on HBO or Netflix or whatever. And I said, let me just sit down and watch the show from beginning to end. And I fucking loved those credits as a New Yorker.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, you know, I went to school in Philadelphia. I have done that drive from Manhattan into New Jersey so many times. You know, I actually love the moment in the episode where a plane flew by and my immediate thought was, oh, that looks like it just took off from Newark.
Yeah.
You know, just thinking about the New Jersey-ness of it. And I think the timing of it and trying to focus on Jersey is totally appropriate, because I think around the same time, or maybe it was after the peak of this, but like the Gotti family was always in the news and like kind of slightly iconically New York. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? And so it's like we got to evolve from that. And how do we do that? Part of it is moving from one of the mob capitals to someplace else. Like, we moving on up. We in the suburbs now. I mean, you look at The Godfather, Michael left Long Island for Vegas.
Yep.
You know, like, you got to evolve, you got to move. And I think part of this story is, how do you evolve? And we do it from the very beginning. You were leaving New York and putting this story firmly in New Jersey. It's a different time, a different era, a different place.
Yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned sort of the iconic, you know, scenery of New York, because it made me think about another change that the show made. So this show debuted, I think, in 99. So I think it's the first three seasons, there's an image of the Twin Towers. And then, like in season four, I think they made the change and took that shot out and made it sort of more like generic New York high rise, you know, skyscrapers as opposed to the Twin mm-hmm. Towers. So just like a weird like tidbit, you know, we talked about 9/11 during our last episode, and I think it's going to continue to come up as we cover shows that were filmed in that time period. It just goes to show just sort of how far reaching, you know, the impact of that very tragic event was.
I'll say that the aspect ratio was also an indicator of the time, right? Like, I was surprised mm-hmm. when I pulled it up on my TV how square it was.
Yeah.
I was like, wait, am I watching this on Instagram? Like, what the fuck is happening? And I was like, oh, yeah. Not that long ago, our aspect ratio was completely different. Not everything was fucking widescreen. And I was just like, God damn, like, how old is this show? Because it kind of feels like yesterday a little bit. But that's also a sign of my age, that everything feels like yesterday because I'm so fucking old.
Yes, yes. Yes, it is very much a product of its time visually. Even just sort of the way the coloring of some of the scenes, it's like this feels, it's like The Walking Dead. It's like this feels like another era, like another period of time. So we talked about the intro. I think this is a great segue because we talked about like the opening credits and how sort of that lays this great foundation for what's to come. I think another very like iconic part of this pilot is the opening. So, you know, the first shot that we see of Tony and Dr. Melfi's office and sort of what we get to know about him in maybe like the first 10 minutes or so, like up until the point where we see him collecting the debt with Christopher and you know, hitting the guy with his car. And like you said, asking him, are you all right? So tell us a little bit more about like your initial impressions of Tony Soprano, you know, from this very like memorable 10 minute stretch.
I couldn't get the ducks out of my goddamn head. Right? So like I was confused as hell because I was able to relate so much to him and these ducks.
Wow.
Like the sheer delight and being excited and like, I'm gonna have food ready for you. And I swear to God, when I saw the ramp, my eyes bugged out because I was like, this bitch built a ramp for these ducks. He didn't even need to say it to them. Like I saw it. I was like, this might be some shit I would do.
Oh my goodness. Christine, are we doing a spoiler segment? Because if we don't do a full-blown spoiler segment, at the end, I want to come back to Tony and the ducks. But keep going.
I feel like we have to. We have to. Well, maybe we should just make that a part of these conversations where we're just like, we gonna spoil shit. And I'm here for it. Because we keep choosing series that are like 25 seasons long with 80 episodes per season. And I'm like, I don't have the time to invest in watching all of this. So just give me the Cliff Notes version of what happens.
But I'm sorry, keep going.
Yeah, but you contrast that delight and joy and care and love. Like, he fucking loves these ducks. Mm-hmm. These are his babies, you know? You contrast that with going into the house and completely ignoring his wife. Like, the volume level is just on, like, one or two. Mm-hmm. He's barely hearing her. And then, you know, talking to his nephew, he's so fucking annoyed with Christopher. And then you see the level of delight again. The only time you see him smile is when he's in the car chasing this man down. Like, he enjoyed that.
While reading the book about the ducks. Don't forget, he had that book in his lap that he was reading while Christopher was driving him.
Oh, my God. So, like, the shit that he takes delight in don't make sense together.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? But I think, of course, it does make sense when you enlighten me to things like he loves animals way more than he does people. And I'm like, I can start to see that. that he's going to all of this care for these random ass Canadian ducks. And, you know, and then just not being there emotionally, mentally for his family. I mean, mm-hmm. I feel like I didn't see that again until his talk with his daughter after the volleyball game.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Which was still a little bit of a blind for doing business.
Absolutely.
So I kind of still didn't know how to feel about his attendance at her volleyball game, which was also outside. And I was like, who the fuck plays six-person volleyball, like court volleyball
outdoors
in Jersey? Yes. I'm very confused. As somebody who played indoor court volleyball, stress, indoor court volleyball for 7 years, okay? Like, that shit was just bizarre to me. Anyway. Maybe chalk that to one of the things I did not like about the pilot. Let's have some believable volleyball games, people. Anyway, but yeah, that contrast was just like a strong indicator that this was going to be a very complicated character mm-hmm. that is going to have, you know, these relatable moments, at least for me. You know, I found the ducks very, very, very relatable. But to be honest, I also found the tuning your family out a little bit relatable as well.
Yes. Yes. So I love that you brought up the contrast because there was one that stood out to me too. So you have the opening credits, right? And it's almost like that song and that imagery, it almost gives you like an adrenaline rush. And you walk away from it feeling like, okay, I don't know. I know this guy's in the mafia. I don't know what his role is, but he seems like someone who gets shit done. Like, you know, that he's probably someone that's pretty important. And so I thought it was interesting to go from like that impression from the opening credits to then this much like more diminished view of him. Like he seems so much smaller when he's in Dr. Melfi's office and you're getting the shot of him between like the legs of the statue of the woman. And he just looks so tiny and understated and just quiet. And I'm like, this is not the guy that I literally just watched riding through, you know, riding out of New York into New Jersey like a badass. So that definitely, you know, stood out to me in this sort of opening 10-minute stretch. I also loved, we talked about the use of silence in the series finale, and I think that it's a nice bookend to the use of silence in these opening moments, particularly the uncomfortable silence between Tony and Dr. Melfi, where, you know, there's a few moments where they're just like, you know, he's quietly in the waiting area, and then he comes in to her office, and there's just sort of this awkward, like, stare down. They're just looking at each other until she finally breaks it. So I love how, and those are actually the only two episodes that David Chase ever wrote. So I kind of love that he played with silence in the two episodes that he actually wrote. So that I enjoyed as well and stood out to me in that stretch. I also, so there are a lot of people that feel like it's a nod to The Graduate. There's like this scene in The Graduate where like the Dustin Hoffman character, Ben Braddock, is like seen looking through the view of the legs of Mrs. Robinson. So you see her leg like in the forefront, and then in the background you see Ben looking through. And obviously, like, you know, for those of you who've watched The Graduate, you know that it's like about this character who is like struggling with his relationships and his interactions with women. And so if it was a nod to that, I thought it was a very fitting one, because much of The Sopranos and even much of what we saw in the pilot is very much about Tony navigating his relationships with the women in his life. And that certainly doesn't change as the series progresses. I also like, in terms of getting to know Tony in first impressions is like this pride and sort of this undeserved like confidence in himself that he kind of thinks that he's always the smartest person in the room. Like he really felt like he was in control of that session. Like, okay, I'm just going to come in here because I'm just here because I can't be passing out in front of people because that's fucking embarrassing and that's going to make me look weak. So let me just get a little bit of tape and glue from this psychiatrist and so I can go about my way. And the way he's just talking to her, like, yeah, you know, I've looked into therapy before. I know what it's all about. But then, like, later in the episode, this is a dude who called fucking Hannibal Lecter Hannibal Lecture. So it's like, Tony, you are not as fucking smart as you think you are, but I love it. Like, fake it until you make it, babe. But I felt like that opening scene was very much a preview into sort of how he wants others to view him. And I have a little bit more. There's a whole lot of stuff with him and Dr. Melfi that just sort of just baffles me in terms of like how he's presenting himself to her versus what we actually know about him just from the pilot alone. In terms of the ducks, we had recently, like in our Castle Slack, I had recently been talking to our friend Daphne about Fiddler on the Roof and, you know, and Tevye and how he's like going through this really like complicated part of his life because his daughter is about to get married. And like, there's this song like Tradition. Like, it's like, that's what it's about. It's like Tevye is struggling with the idea that things are about to significantly change because his kids are growing up. They're going to leave the home. And I felt like Tony was very much having a Tevye fiddler on the roof moment with the ducks, because I, you know, obviously the ducks had some symbolism with respect to his family. His kids are getting older. They're going to be moving on soon. And he's having, maybe that's some of his anxiety and some of the depression that he's facing. Although I think that there are other people, like, you know, his mom in particular, that are to blame for that. But I also had like this random thought. So when he comes from the pool and he comes into the house with his family, like he comes in, presumably he's got his swimming trunks on and he's got his towel wrapped around his waist, but he's like shirtless. And I don't know why that just felt really weird to me. I started thinking about like my own childhood.
Because there's a guest in the house.
Yes,
there's a fucking guest in the house.
Yes.
That shit bothered me so much. Oh my God. And not just like any guest, but your daughter's
best friend. Yes.
It's so inappropriate.
Yes. Yes. That, because I had to like sit back and think about like growing up. And I thought about how like, like my stepfather, I've never seen that man without a shirt on. Like if he didn't have a shirt on, he was in the bedroom with the door closed and he certainly wouldn't have been milling about casually around the house if we had company. And like same with my mom is very much like, she might get up and start breakfast in her nightgown and robe, but you know, it's not like you see some arm, you see some leg, but it's not just like, it's not just out there. And it certainly wouldn't be out there. If we had company, everybody is getting fully dressed before they come out and present themselves in front of the company. And I probably should have thought about, unpacked it a little bit more and thought about, like, what does this say about him? Like, this comfort level. And maybe it speaks to what you said. Like, the fact that he just don't give a fuck about nobody that was in the room at that time. And he's like, I'm just going to come up in here dripping wet from the pool with no shirt on. But it was just so weird. I'm like, sir, put on, like, I know you have a robe. I know he got the robe wet in the pool. But I'm like, you must have another robe. For the love of Ray J, would you please put it on when your daughter has company over?
There were so many confusing beats in that moment, and it was all about clothing. Like, I was so confused why he wore the robe into
in the pool. Yes.
With the ducks, and then not the robe when he was in front of his daughter's friend.
Yes.
Like, it was completely backwards.
Yes.
Completely ass backwards. And I was just sitting there like shaking my head like, what does this mean?
Yes. Yes.
I was so confused. But you know, I wanted to talk about the silence that you were mentioning between him and Melfi at the very beginning of their session, and how you were talking about how he really thought he was the one managing that whole conversation. Silence is a power move.
Yes. Yes,
right?
It is.
Like, it's always a power move. I love forcing people into saying the first thing. Like, I actually think that shit is fun. It's enjoyable. A lot of people are uncomfortable with silence.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, like, of course, he took his semester and a half, you know, at college and knows about Freud and whatnot.
Right.
And, you know, clearly therapists want to talk. And maybe he thought that, like, being quiet was going to be the power move. And here's the thing, like, you want the other person to speak first. So there is this false sense of him being in control because Melfi is the first one to break, right? But bitch, she knows what she's
doing. She knew exactly what she was doing.
She's the professional in the room here. Come on.
Right.
Come on, my dude. But yeah, I thought that that was really interesting, but also probably still the way I would go about it, because it's like, I'm here to see you. You talk.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I'm, you know, I'm far more engaged with therapy in that I know I need to do the work. So let me be open and let me start talking and all of that shit. But at the same time, that first meeting is super awkward because you kind of don't know where to go. There's so many ways in which you can start talking about all the terrible shit, you know, that you're trying to deal with and all of the madness that's in your head that you're trying to work out. And where do you start? So it's like, why don't you start? Right. A little bit. But it was 100% a power move with him. And I could appreciate that. You tried it, Tony. You tried.
You tried it. She was running the show. And I feel like she immediately clocked it. And she's like, okay, I'm gonna give him this. I'm gonna let him think this. And then we'll just go from there. And then just two other really quick moments. Two quick points. The ease with which he lied to Dr. Melfi was obviously disturbing and I think a really good insight into his character. I mean, I think that on the one hand, you understand that he's telling these lies because he's obviously involved in a criminal fucking enterprise. So there's only so much like candor that he can share with her. But it wasn't just that. There were also those lies about sort of himself and how he feels like people view him and how he views himself. Mm-hmm. I'm like, these lies are not necessary to you protecting your criminal activity. So that was a nice preview. And I'm like, okay, if I had been watching it for the first time, it would have certainly made me wonder, like, okay, there is something wrong with you. Like, you lie way too easy. Like, you lie so easily, it's kind of scary, actually. And then, of course, the other thing that shocked me was Tony doing his own dirty work. Going back to the scene that you talked about where he and Christopher are collecting a debt. And I'm like, you know, you're the guy who has a driver. You are walking around in a suit. And you actually like got out of the car to rough this guy up. Like that kind of seems, they don't seem like they go well together. It's like, you probably shouldn't be the one that's out here doing the dirty work. So that was also interesting. I'm like, why are you out here roughing up someone? Not only are you doing the dirty work, but you are doing it in broad fucking daylight in front of witnesses. Like, of course, there's a point of it that's like, okay, people might know who he is and they would never come forward, but it still just seems like unnecessarily risky and just speaks to, I don't know, a carelessness about the character that I do think changes over the course of this series, but it was an interesting sort of place to start with him as we see him doing his work.
See, that scene was what led me to believe that he was the boss. I didn't realize that he was, you know, a prince within the kingdom, you know? I thought that Tony was a boss, clearly. Because he got out of the car in broad daylight. He just got out of the car. Let's back up a little bit. Homeboy took this car and chased this man down through an entire campus filled with witnesses. So that was number one. Then chose to strike the man with the car. That was number two. And then got out and put his own hands and feet on that man.
Yes, he did.
So, like, he did the absolute most in that moment. And it seemed like he was untouchable. That was my reaction to that scene. So I just assumed he had to be the boss. That absolutely no one would dare snitch on fucking Tony Soprano. Are you fucking kidding? No way. He's a known quantity. Everybody knows that face, knows that name, knows the power behind it, and you don't fuck with it.
Interesting. Yeah, I was like, dude, real G's move in silence and violence. Like, this is not what we do in broad daylight, my guy. Like, come on. You're supposed to be a boss. Christine, if you
sometimes you want to get in touch with your roots, though, of your business, right? Sometimes, like, you move on past a certain thing, and you know, but sometimes it's just nice to revisit those days where it was like, hey, I actually enjoyed my job coming up.
I mean, listen, I get that a little fisticuffs can be fun from time to time, but as the series progresses, I think he gets a little bit more discerning about where and when he does it. And so to me, it sort of pointed out to how to even as established as he is and how much he thinks he knows that he's still very green at this point in his development. Christine, if you're Dr. Melfi, do you take on Tony Soprano as a patient, even though you know full damn well that he's a member of the mafia?
Yeah. So I don't know if I'm actually answering your question. Probably not. But I will say that as I was watching this show, I was thinking that if I was a mob boss, I would encourage a few of the young people in the family to study psychology.
Okay, so you can keep it in the family.
Yes.
Okay,
so you have like
smart.
An in-house therapist.
Yeah.
Not to mention so much of the work that they do is rooted in psychology, right? Like you're playing chess with how things are going to play out based on how certain human beings are going to behave, right? So I feel like a psychologist on the team would be an amazing strategist. So I'm like, you know, if I'm some random therapist, am I going to take in Tony Soprano? Honestly, maybe.
Oh my God, Christine.
No, because like I'm intrigued. Like, listen, you and I sit here and we talk about stories, right? Can you imagine the stories that a fucking mob boss is going to come into your office and share to you? I mean, this is going to be amazing entertainment that he pays me for, you know?
Like, oh my God.
The stories will be, listen, okay. So the danger level kind of high.
Mm-hmm.
You never know if the feds are going to come to you and be like, yo, we heard that you're his therapist and blah, blah, blah. And then you're in this funky place of, you know, dealing with doctor-client privilege and also your ethical duties. Like, what do you know? What do you not know? What did you report? What did you not report? Like the feds leaning on you, the mob leaning on you. Like it's not a fun place to be.
No,
it's not. But I feel like a part of me would be like, the stories he would tell would be fascinating. Like this would be such a challenge of a client. How could you turn this down? This would be like the client of your career. How could you turn this down? How could you?
So my thought was, listen, at some point, shit's going to get hot and y'all going to have to tie up loose ends. And guess whose black ass ain't going to be a loose end? This guy. So, no, thank you. I think everyone deserves access to healthcare. But, sir, I will write you several referrals to other qualified people. I'll write you a referral to Dr. Christine Kippens and see if she's willing to take you on as a client. But as for me and mine, no. Not having it. And then I also think that even if I did say, okay, I'm going to throw caution to the wind, I'm going to take him on as a client, the fucking lies he tells. And you can tell from the jump, she sees right through his bullshit. Mm-hmm. To me, that would probably be a deterrent because even as entertaining as the stories are, I'm going to know that there's like maybe one nugget or grain of truth, but everything else is going to probably be a fucking lie. Yeah. So from like just a from a practitioner's perspective, I would be like, can I really help someone who has the complete inability to be truthful and to be themselves with me? Like, I'm not asking them to tell me about every crime they commit, but you can't come in here talking about like you're the strong and silent type when you're actually like out in the streets being the exact fucking opposite of that. So yeah. I would probably see that as being a barrier to me even being able to help him. So no. And like I said, I am not trying to be a loose end. I'm not trying to turn up in anybody's river with some cement blocks tied to my ass. No, thank you. I would tell him I wish you the best, but you gotta go. I think the only way it would happen is if he threatened me and I'd be like, well, fuck, I don't have a choice now because he gonna kill me if I don't do it. But otherwise, I would have to politely, I would refer him to you for help. That is what I would do.
Okay, rewind. What kind of blocks?
Cinder blocks? Like cement blocks?
Cement?
Yeah.
Is that how y'all pronounce it in Richmond?
Yeah.
Virginia,
what is it?
You
cement? It's cement.
Cement.
It's cement. Okay? It is cement. It is cement. Y'all know I'm country. I've lived in Philadelphia for a very long time, but the country is still there, and it's a cement block, and I ain't going to be tied to no fucking chains in a cement block getting dropped in the bottom of the Hudson River because I fucked around and tried to treat this motherfucker that can't be helped. So, I will not be a loose end. I will not be doing anything with no cement. Nope, not doing it. I'm sorry, sir. I cannot help you. Sorry to this man. I don't know this man. I've never seen this man before. So, Christine, as someone who has not seen the entire series, I'd love to hear you speculate a little bit as to where you think things are going to go, particularly, well, not where things are going to go, but a more specific question. Let's assume, like, there's no way this doesn't get out to the members of Tony's mafia family. How are they going to receive the news that, you know, the guy that they're working for, the guy who is being positioned to be the boss, is in therapy?
I mean, Tony already started this fucking rumor by acknowledging the therapist at the restaurant, mm-hmm. right? So her date or her man or whoever that is was like, decorator my ass. Like, he's a client of yours? So people are already figuring shit out. I know this man's going to run his damn mouth because he just does not look intelligent at all. But I think, particularly coming from a West Indian family, there's so many parallels between, like, immigrant families, right? So, like, I know that these people are going to be like, this is a weakness. You can't handle your problems. You don't tell people your problems because, one, that's a sign you can't handle them yourself. Two, you don't air dirty laundry. Like, you don't talk outside the family, mm-hmm. right? Plus, it seems like they're looking for any fucking reason to topple him, right? So it's like, if you don't have the mental chops for the job, you gotta go. So, yeah, it's not looking good for Tony.
When we get to the spoiler section, I think your instincts are right, but remind me to tell you how it gets out because... It's just, it's a mess. What did you think about the choice to make Tony as the narrator of events in this pilot episode? And I ask this question because it is a change from the pilot versus the rest of the series. This is the only episode where we're in his headspace and where he is the narrator of events.
So I kind of liked it because it made me feel like I was also his therapist. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That he was talking directly to me. He's giving me insight into what's going on in his head. So we're getting direct access. And I like that. And to me, it was also kind of fun to figure out when he's lying to us mm-hmm. and potentially to himself. You know, like, the lies that he tells might not necessarily be for our benefit.
Right.
You know, that they're actually more for him. So, yeah, I dug it.
Yeah. I think it helped in the efficiency of sort of setting out the landscape and allowing us to get to know him in a solid hour of television. It just sort of, mm-hmm. I think it just added to the efficiency of the storytelling and the world building. So I liked it quite a bit. And I think it was the right choice, though, to walk it back, you know, as the series progresses and not do it anymore, because then it just makes it more suspenseful because, you know, you're trying mm-hmm. to figure out how he's going to respond, how he's going to receive things. And you're not getting, you know, that firsthand perspective or what he wants you to think is the actual series of events. Mm-hmm. You're actually seeing them play out in real time. So we know that Tony is not a reliable narrator. Did you think that there was anything more to the way in which he relays his story to Dr. Melfi? Like, it's very obvious at, like, a broader level that he's not going to, like, sit in front of her and, like, walk her through all the crimes he committed throughout the course right. of the day. But how about sort of the choices to, like, tell lies about things that had nothing to do with his criminal activity? Like, you know, what was your read on that?
So I didn't pick up all the lies. I did think that it was interesting that he wouldn't go into the details of the crimes because, mm-hmm. you know, homegirl flagged very early on, don't do that
yeah.
or else I will have to report you. But he still brought up RICO. He still brought up the RICO statute. And I was like, like, what are you doing?
And another funny moment. Because she was like, who is RICO?
But you're your brother?
You're right.
Who's hunky dory? Right. Yeah, no. So like, yeah, thinking that Rico was his brother was absolutely hilarious. I'm like, nah, bitch, the Rico statue. Right. I know you went seeking for this client because you and the doctor clearly talked. You were from the neighborhood. You know who the fuck he is. Mm-hmm. Like, come on. Everybody knows what Rico is.
Yes.
With the mob? I mean, come on. Anyway, I thought that it was more about lying to himself than to her, like mm-hmm. trying to minimize all of the violence so that it's minimized in his head, so that it's not a big deal. We don't even need to discuss it, whatever, moving on to whatever else. But yeah, I'd be far more interested to know your thoughts on it because you clearly picked up on more lies than I did.
Well, I think it's a preview into like how manipulative he is, because I think one of the questions that sort of is a common thread throughout the course of this series, and I think ultimately the writers grapple with it in the final season, is therapy really helping him, or is it making him a better liar and a better criminal? And so I think we get a preview into that because, you know, in the way that he's like trying to paint himself, like the sad clown thing in particular really bothered me. Like, yes, he's a clown. Mm. He likes to joke around and goof off at times. But I'm like, sir, you are not a fucking sad clown. Like, yes, I understand that you are depressed and that you're having anxiety issues, but this idea that he's a sad clown, like that he's just in so much pain on the inside and that he puts on this brave face when he's dealing with everyone else, I'm like, everyone in a fucking room with you knows where the fuck you stand. Like, you have no poker face, Tony, none whatsoever. Like, you practice restraint on some occasions, but I get, you know, you get the sense that people know where they stand with him, that he doesn't, you know, mince words. So it just didn't ring true with me. And I felt like it was disrespectful to Dr. Melfi. And it goes to this whole idea of him thinking that he's the smartest person in the room because he's kind of thought about how he needs to paint himself, how he wants her to view him for the purposes of this treatment that he's getting. So it just felt like a whole bunch. He's just full of shit, which he is full of shit as a character. And so I just found it frustrating because, like I said, I felt like it was an insult to her. And there's like one moment, I think, where does he call her Melfi? He refers to her and he doesn't use doctor. Yes. And she has to clock right. him on that. And to me, it's sort of all part of this, I think, lack of respect for her intelligence and for her being able to do her job. And I almost find it insulting that he felt like he could just, you know, mosey on into this room and tell all these lies about the person that he wants her to believe that he is. And maybe in some respects, he does think that he's this person, and not give her enough credit that she's good enough at her job to think that she might be able to see through some of it. And I think that's an ongoing issue in the course of his therapy, you know, him coming in with the bullshit at times. I mean, it does get more candid as the therapy progresses, but her having to call him out on his bullshit and getting to that level where she's comfortable enough to call him out on it.
I'm sure some of it is rooted in misogyny as well, you know, that like it'd be very different if it was Dr. Christopher Melfi
yes.
or something.
It would have been
speaking to him.
Yes, it would have been a completely different approach had it been a man, I'm certain. So we've talked about the dynamic between Tony and Dr. Melfi, but I want to get into some of the other character dynamics in the show. Christine, what's your read on Tony and Uncle June?
I think Tony is in complete denial on his relationship with Uncle June, Uncle Junior. Like, everything is hunky-dory, there's some tension, but whatever, he'll listen to me because I'm the boss and blah, blah, blah. Like, he doesn't seem to realize just how insulted and sensitive Uncle Junior is.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very nervous about that relationship because that conversation that Uncle Junior had with Tony's mom in the car, I was like... What? This is escalating, folks.
Yes.
This is definitely escalating. And the amount of shenanigans that Tony has to go through in order to subvert his uncle's intentions was just, it was a lot. Like, y'all seriously can't talk about this and come to some sort of resolution?
Mm-hmm.
You have to bomb your friend's restaurant?
Poor Artie Bucco.
Jesus Christ.
Yes. I love that you point that out about him not fully understanding the level of resentment. I think Hesh tries to tell him when they have that scene at Bada Bing, the strip club. And I called him Uncle June because he does call him. I don't want people to think like I'm like calling him Uncle June when his name is Junior. Tony does affectionately call him Uncle June throughout the series. So I might go back and forth between June and Junior.
Mm. But that's good to know.
But I completely agree. Like, Tony doesn't understand that. So in particular, with the plan to whack little pussy Malenga, that was clearly Uncle June taking a piss on Tony. And Tony just had a complete blind spot to it. That plan was as much about setting up little pussy and in a place where he would be comfortable. It was as much about that as it was Uncle Junior making it known to Tony, I'm the one in charge. I make the calls. And so I'm specifically choosing this place of business that's owned by your childhood friend. Like, it is a fucking slight, and it is meant to be a slight. And it just, it goes back to that whole thing. Tony is always fucking thinking that he's the smartest person in the room. And I'm like, my dude, you've got some blind spots. And when we get to spoilers, we'll talk about, you know, if he sort of course corrects the blind spots or not. But speaking of other blind spots, Christine, let's talk about Tony and his mom, Livia. give me your breakdown. What was your read on that toxic relationship in the pilot?
God. So y'all can't see me. Jocelyn's laughing because I basically have my whole face in my hands.
Yes.
Because this relationship was like the most painful thing to watch.
Yes.
In this episode. I mean, and it's also, I think, a little relatable because there comes a point where the child becomes the parent.
Mm-hmm.
And the parent becomes the child. And I don't know about y'all, but this pandemic accelerated that timeline for me,
mm-hmm.
where my parents were doing some dumb shit and I had to clock their asses, mm-hmm. right? Like, I had to swoop in and be the disciplinarian with them and speak to them in a manner that was very reminiscent of my childhood. Like, and it came out of nowhere,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it was very natural and instinctive. And after a couple of weeks of it, you know, I started talking to some friends and we were all doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, all of us 40 somethings now are the parents of our parents. And it's a whole new world and it's stressful and it's complicated and it's frightening because it's like, how the fuck did I get here?
Mm-hmm.
What do I do with this? And as annoying as it is for us, I feel like it's got to be 10 times worse for them because they've been in this position where for the entirety of our lives, they have managed us.
Mm-hmm.
They are not the ones to be managed. You get to a certain age, you don't give a fuck about anything anymore.
Mm-hmm.
How dare your children try to tell you how to live your grown ass life.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, it's this very complicated, tension-filled point in the natural relationship between a parent and child when, God willing, you're all able to get to that age together.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So I feel for both of them. At the same time, holy shit, she's a terror all by herself.
Yes. Yes.
She, like, the way she treated him when Tony came to drop off that CD player.
Oh, my God.
Was so lovingly abusive.
Yes.
Like, let me give you some food. No, Mom, I already ate. And first of all, it took her half an hour to let him into the house in the first place.
And you know, she fucking heard him.
Right. And then, you know, completely ignoring the fact that he already ate and still giving food. Like, you know, giving food is a sign of love, always. It doesn't matter who you're giving it to. That is a sign of respect and care and love. And even though the person says, no, I'm full, you still give them food. I feel like that's a cultural thing for some of us. That's definitely the way I was raised. The worst possible thing that could happen during a party is you run out of food and booze. Like, that is the sign that you need to go into the closet, close the door, and just never come out because you're a terrible human being, okay? So I get that. I get that, but like some of the shit that she said to him was absolutely terrible. She abused him the entire time he was there, and then he leaves and she goes, well, run off. And I was just like, oh, that's such a mind fuck, because you abuse him the whole time he's there and then you guilt trip him when he leaves. It was terrible. And then that scene with her and Uncle Junior in the car. I have so many confusing feelings about that because it seemed as though she was smelling what he was cooking.
Right? Yeah, I don't think that was ambiguous. That was absolutely, she
understood the threat. She understood the threat. And she's of the generation, I believe, where the women say nothing. You make the babies, you make the sauce, you keep your trap shut. That was the job of a mob wife when she was coming up, right? She knows her place in this mob family. So when she hears this shit, she's like, I gotta say nothing. But to me, at the same time, this is a very strong indicator of the generational story that this show might be trying to tell. It's their generation, the older generation, versus Tony's generation versus Christopher's generation, right?
Right.
Like, and then you complicate things with the blood family dynamics. So whose team is she on? Is she on the team of her generation? Is she on the team of her blood? Like, what the fuck is she doing? And Tony has to deal with all four, right? Their generation, his generation, the next generation coming up in his blood family. Like, this was, to me, a pretty pivotal moment in the pilot. And then she walks into the party, goes to her son, and it's not the first thing out of her mouth.
Right.
So I thought that shit was wild. It was absolutely wild. And honestly, it's the one thing that makes me want to watch the subsequent episodes. Like, I want to know what happens with her and Tony and that piece of information that she got in that car. It's honestly the one thing that makes me want to watch episode two.
Yeah. So Livia is a piece of shit. I mean, she's toxic. She's sick. She's narcissistic. You know, Tony is very manipulative, and he comes by it honestly because his mom is just as manipulative. And what stood out to me, it's that blind spot that he has. And it's that scene where they're at her house and he brings her the CD player. And all he wants is like her love and approval. All he wants is to be appreciated. And the bitch starts talking about how daughters are better caretakers of their moms than sons. Like, after he's done this nice thing, like, that scene alone, it just speaks volumes about the nature of their relationship. Because we do end up meeting, Tony has two sisters. One of them is just like, you know, she has her shit together. She has a family. She has nothing to do with all of this. But Janice, on the other hand, is a big old sack of shit, just like her mom, and also manipulative. And if she comes to town wanting to do something nice for you, there is going to always be an angle. There is always a fucking hustle. She is very much her mother's daughter. So, you know, having sort of that knowledge and rewatching it, it was like, wow. Like, it's one of the few moments where I actually kind of feel bad for Tony, because I'm like, he wants it so bad and he is just taking it on the chin from this woman over and over and over again. But yet he still wants her to come to AJ's birthday party. Mm-hmm. He still wants her to be very much part of his life. And I think your instincts about whether or not she was picking up what Uncle Junior was putting down, absolutely she was. And what I would say about her is that it's always intentional. It's never like, oh, I was confused. Like, she made the choice not to tell Tony about it. That was a choice that she made. She's a monster, but their dynamic is one of the most, like, interesting parts of this entire series. It's just so, she's a great actress, he's a great actor, so their scenes are really great together. But I love hearing sort of your train of thought. I don't want to, like, veer too much into it, because there's a fine line between, like, what I see in the pilot and what I know. And I have a little bit of a hard time separating the two when I think about the scenes with them. But yes, she's a monster. And to the point of, to your point about, like, women her age being silent. Yes, there's silence, but it's obvious that she's a confidant of Uncle Junior's.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what she says and what she doesn't say, it's always purposeful. I mean, Uncle June picked up what she was putting down. He knows that she was aligned with it, at least in that moment as well, that they both understood that Tony was a problem. So I can't wait till we get to the spoiler section. So I'm going to put a pin in that one now and talk about one of the other complicated dynamics on this show. And that is between Tony and Carmela, who is just brilliantly played by Edie Falco. I love her. She won tons of awards for being Carmela Soprano. Christine, I'd love to hear your thoughts about the Tony and Carmela of it all, especially her choice to tell him that he was going to fucking hell after he's had this major medical emergency. Dude is, like, laid out getting, I'm assuming, some sort of head scan. And it's in that moment you decided to tell him that he was going to go to hell? Like, ma'am, I know that you are clearly not pleased with some things, but it just, like, it's another rare moment in which I actually felt sorry for him, despite the fact that we know he's got a Gumar, he's a cheater, he's, you know, but it was like, dude, you could have, like, saved that until he was maybe feeling better. I don't know, Carmela. Christine, what did you think about Miss Carmela?
So that was one of the moments where I cracked up. Like, she said she's there to keep him company. And the last thing she says to him is that the difference between you and me is that you're going to hell when you die.
Yes.
And then he goes into the machine and she has the nerve to hold his hand. And I just, like, fell out. Oh my God, clearly I still find that shit absolutely hilarious. It's such, like, a husband-wife moment where, like, they clearly don't like each other. Mm-hmm. Like, this is kind of a business arrangement at this point. Like, she knows that she's kind of resigned to an internal partnership with him.
Mm-hmm.
She knows what it means to be a wife of a crime boss. She's up for it. I mean, listen, when she pulled that automatic rifle on her child,
yes,
and her child was like, what? I was looking for putty to put on the side of the house. Like, did not, like, that was her response, not, oh my God, Ma, you pulled a fucking automatic rifle on me.
Right.
Like, clearly this family knows what's up.
Oh, right? Yeah.
They know what's up. And I think Carmela has maybe seen from other relationships, or maybe from her own parents' relationship. Maybe she was, like, brought up in a crime family. Maybe she was just like her daughter. And kind of has seen this relationship play out with her own parents, you know? And it's just like, you have kids together, you manage the kids, and you keep your trap shut. I have no idea, but like, she obviously does care about him a little bit because she's concerned about his soul.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, she was so excited. This is another moment when I laughed. When, over dinner, when he admits that he's having therapy.
Yeah.
And she's like, oh my God, this is so great. It's like confession. I mean, it's not confession, but it's as close as you're going to get.
Right.
Oh my God. But she's concerned about his soul, which is great, because if I don't give a shit about you, fuck you and your soul. I don't give a shit where you end up. In fact, I might say, can't wait to see you in hell.
Okay, so I love the points that you made about the Carmela and Tony dynamic. Just a few quick thoughts. Like, I mean, she's the typical mafia wife, right? Like, she knows what the deal is. She signed up for it. They've made the partnership, but she's still gonna bitch about it from time to time, as is her right. Yes. That's totally fine. I also loved, like, this idea of her squirreling away the money and the soup can. And so I wondered, like, is she squirreling away the money for a rainy day fund in case they separate or divorce? Or is she squirreling away money in case he gets locked up because his brother Rico gets him caught up in a bad situation and she's not confident that the family's going to take care of her? I mean, I like that for all of the shit sandwiches that she's that she's accepting in this marriage, that she seems like a woman who is thinking about sort of, you know, the what ifs, like what happens if this all goes wrong? You know, I need to have funds. I hate it. I know we're talking about Tony and Carmela, but God, I hated everything. I hated the way Meadow treated her. I don't know that there are any two kids I've hated more on a TV show than Meadow and AJ at different times and for different reasons. But my God, they're insufferable. And I don't really advocate people beating their children. Like, I think that people should find other ways. But if there were ever two kids who should have got their ass whooped on a regular fucking basis with a switch or a belt, it's those two bitches. I can't stand them. Okay, I've gone off on a tangent. So, any other thoughts about their relationship, or should we move on? All right, so let's move on. So, I've been talking about, like, my frustration with Tony and him sort of trying to present himself as one type. In particular, when he's talking to Dr. Melfi, he's like, well, what happened to the Gary Coopers of the world? In other words, what happened to the strong, silent types? I know it's just been one episode, Christine, but is Tony Soprano a fucking Gary Cooper?
Listen, let me tell you, the strong silent type died of like heart attacks, all right? Because they kept everything in. So like, let's not praise the Gary Cooper types and their toxic masculinity.
Yes.
I mean, Tony seems to be enjoying therapy.
Yes.
He seems to be getting quite the benefit from it. You know, he's so excited to see his therapist at the restaurant and out himself and, you know, make sure she's set up with a nice table because she's clearly providing an amazing benefit in his life, even if he's not willing to admit that it's her.
Mm-hmm.
And he wants to say that it's the Prozac. But yeah, he's not the strong silent type. He might be the strong type, but he's not the silent type.
At all. Like, sir, I think that's the lie that really, that and the sad clown, those are the two. I was like, God, you're just the fucking worst. like I kind of feel like he enjoys being able to put on this performance and having this escape where he can pretend that he's all of these things that he feels like he should be, but in reality, he really isn't. Any other thoughts about Tony and Dr. Melfi?
I love their dynamic.
Yeah.
I'm really interested by it.
Yeah, it is one of the best aspects of the series. I mean, the series is just good for so many reasons, but that particular dynamic is certainly a standout. The only other thing I wanted to mention, and it's a scene that you just talked about when he tells Carmela about being in therapy. I felt like that was also completely manipulative. Like, it kind of felt like he knew he was on her bad side, that she was kind of getting to that point where she was at capacity with his bullshit. So he's like, all right, I got to throw her a bone to get off my shit, at least temporarily. So he pulls the therapy card. And, you know, I'm not that's the nature of their dynamic. But I did just note, I was like, you didn't really want to like bring her into this process. You just said that shit because she told your ass you were going to hell and you're like, oh, her, she getting sick of my shit. I need to, you know, show her that I'm like making an effort because, you know, for all of the Gumars that Tony has throughout the course of this series, he does love Carmela. And you know, and I don't want to get into spoiler territory, but he values having her in his life and what she brings to his life. Were there any standouts for you, Christine? I mean, I think it goes without saying that James Gandolfini is amazing as Tony. Yeah. So let's just table that. We give him his flowers. He's amazing. But were there any other performances that sort of from an actor who left you wanting to know more about the character they were portraying?
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily say it's the performance. Mm-hmm. Maybe it is. But the therapist, I find extremely fascinating. So Dr. Melfi, first of all, I knew her face and it was nagging me for the entire episode that I couldn't fucking place it.
Yeah, Goodfellas.
I've only seen Goodfellas once.
Oh my God.
It was after. Yeah. I got like a lot of shit for not having seen Goodfellas. And I can't even remember who it was, but it was like my friends sat me down and made me watch Goodfellas. And she was the wife.
Yes. Yes. She was married to Henry Hill. Yes. Yes.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Okay. So one, there was that. And then two, she was clearly interested in mob life and wanted to keep him as a client.
Yeah.
So when she was like that technically shit at the end, when she was like, whoa, before you say anything, let me just set some ground rules and let you know that I need to report you if you say some wild shit.
Mm-hmm.
Technically. So when she said that technically, I was like, oh, you about that life, huh? Like,
absolutely.
This is some interesting shit. Like, you seem really buttoned up and stuff, but you clearly have a taste for danger. And I want to know what that's about. And then her body language during their sessions is like mildly suggestive. Like some of the angles that she was giving him, I was like, girl, I see what you're doing. What's that about?
I'm so glad that you brought that up because I distinctly remember there being a lot of discourse about her body language, the choices of outfits, particularly when she would wear like the skirts and like, you know, cross those long legs and put them out there. There was a ton. Like if we had Twitter at that time, it would be everywhere. But there were, I remember distinctly there being articles and tons of discourse about sort of, you know, her body language and how she presented that character sometimes in their therapy sessions.
Yeah, so I found her extremely intriguing.
Yes, and also you might remember Lorraine Bracco from, I think it was Top Chef All Stars. There's a challenge where they're at this Italian restaurant, and I think it might be the episode where, no, it's not where Fabio makes the bulgur, because that was Jimmy Fallon.
Burger.
But she is in an episode of Top Chef All Stars. And she's amazing in that because she's a big foodie. I love Lorraine Bracco. She's just the best. For me, it was Carmela. I mean, we've seen this woman with her secret stash of cash. We've seen her pull out an assault rifle with relative ease.
On her child.
Yes, on her child, nonetheless. And we've also seen this sort of, I don't know what's up with her and the priest, but Tony clocked it. So I'm like, okay, there is more to this than her just getting like religious counsel. So she was definitely the one. I'm like, I need more of this because as much as she's feeling like a stereotypical mob wife, in many ways, she does feel different and cut from a different cloth. And I also wanted to bring up, just so you know, she comes from a completely vanilla family. Like her dad's not in the mob, her mom's not in the mob, but they all grew up together. So they clearly knew who and what the Soprano family was when she started dating Tony and ultimately married him. But yeah, to your point, nope, there were no mob ties with them. Like I said, completely, like they were civilians, basically. But they knew what it was. They knew who and what Tony was.
Okay, good. Because she seems like the kind of person who went into this with her eyes completely wide open.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that's fair. And so I think I already know the answer from our discussion today, Christine. But let's go ahead and officially render a verdict. Did the pilot episode of The Sopranos leave you wanting more?
Well, it did until you kind of hinted at, like, you know, grandma not telling Tony that, you know, Uncle June is up to some shady shit. And now I'm like, well, do I need to watch anymore? Like, do I need to see how this plays out? But I'm still pretty intrigued by Uncle June. Like, is Uncle June going to try to make good on his threat? And how does Tony foil that if he does? Because clearly he would have to, unless Uncle June lasts for several seasons. So I have a feeling that our spoiler conversation will help me with the final verdict.
Yeah.
But going into this conversation before you fuck things up, I was interested to see how the Uncle June shit was going to play out.
So here's what I would say. Even if you feel like, you know, and obviously I'm going to spoil a bunch of stuff for you in relatively short time. The performances are worth it. And like I said, that dark humor, like there is this episode called Pine Barrens. Everyone knows it. It's like, it's an episode where Chris and Polly like end up stranded in the snow. And it is one of the funniest fucking hours of television I have ever watched. So I would say, regardless of how you feel after I sort of tell you where things end up, it's no replacement for actually like seeing what these actors do and actually seeing sort of the intrigue in terms of how things, you know, sort of roll out. But in that same vein, since we're going to get to spoilers, so before I sully you, while you're still unsullied, Christine.
Yes.
I would love to hear your wildest speculation about anyone. Just pick one character and give me your wildest speculation.
Okay. So you talked a lot about Tony feeling as though he's the smartest person in the room. And I got a lot of the same vibes from Michael. Christopher.
Okay. Christopher.
Sorry. Michael is the actor. From Christopher, his nephew. And so my wild, but probably not that wild, because we know I don't get that wild with my speculation at all, but I'm not that creative. But my speculation is that Christopher, after a while, feels that Tony isn't the smartest person in the room, that it is, in fact, him, and he's not getting the appreciation and attention and, you know, more responsibilities that he deserves. And so he's going to end up being the Fredo of the family and betrays Tony, and then Tony has to put him down.
Okay. I love that wild speculation. I can't wait to give you some insight as to where our darling Christopher ends up. Before we get to the spoiler section, we have to do my favorite part of every episode. Christine, it is time to get thirsty. So, Christine, was there anyone in this pilot who tickled your fancy?
I found it very, very, very dry this episode. My waters were not quenched.
Okay.
There is a drought over at Lake Minnetonka. It's very sad. It's very sad. I had to search and search and search and search. And I found a mirage. And I think it's Niels, the therapist's dinner date. To me, he was the finest person in the episode. No one else did it for me. Not a single soul. And that might also be why I'm like, do I need to watch the rest of this show?
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, man. It was dry. It was a dry, dry episode for me.
I totally get that. I mean, I have one. Y'all know I love a big nose. And the noses don't get better than Michael Imperioli's. So obviously, I think Christopher is hot as fuck. And his nose is a masterpiece. So he is my thirst selection. And there's a character who comes up eventually named Furio that, like, Tony, like, sort of brings into the family from Italy. My God, that character is fucking, like, he speaks in this thick Italian accent. He wears, like, the ponytail. He's very old school Italian, but Woo, child, he was hot. Everyone loved them Sufurio when he was on the show. So, guys, the next thing up is going to be the spoiler section. So, for those of you that don't want to be spoiled, we're going to say goodbye to you now. We thank you for listening.
Arrivederci.
Yes, we love you. Follow us on Twitter and IG at morewinepod. You can send us longer feedback at morewinepod@gmail.com. We will see you guys for the next episode. Peace out. And let's get into the spoilers. Oh my God, I'm so excited about this spoiler section. Okay, boom. Let's start with the therapy. So there is this like ongoing question as to whether or not the therapy is helping or making him a better criminal. And I love that you picked up on the thing with the animals because it's a constant thing that comes up. Like, there is a well-respected captain in the family that Tony basically kills because that dude neglected a horse and the horse ends up dying. It's like this whole ridiculous storyline. Like, Tony had a picture painted of him with the horse and like he wanted to throw it away and burn the picture because he was so upset about the horse dying. And then one of his captains, Polly, like grabs the painting out of the trash and hangs it up in his apartment. And when Tony finds out, he gets pissed. Like, this whole thing, and the horse's name was Pyomai. The whole Pyomai situation was like, whoa, dude. Like, your love of animals, it's, we are officially in the bridge too far at this point. And so as he continues in therapy and he's talking to Dr. Melfi and constantly bringing up these examples of animals, it occurs to him that he's a fucking sociopath and that his love of animals is one of the signs. Like, what appeared at first to be like, oh, he's got this loving side. He does have like the ability to be vulnerable, but it's like, nope, it is textbook sociopath and the love of the animals and the obsession with the animals, particularly when you juxtapose it against how he treats people, he's a fucking sociopath. And as she comes to this revelation, she becomes more and more uncomfortable with her role in this whole process. And she begins to worry that she's just making him a better manipulator, a better criminal, and just basically enabling what he does as opposed to actually addressing his issues. So there does come a point in time where she cuts off the professional relationship and won't be his therapist anymore. And then, like, it's interesting because, like, she goes to therapy. So we see scenes with her and her therapist when she's working through all this shit with Tony. And one of the biggest sort of, I think, points of frustration for a lot of fans of the show is, I can't remember if it's like season two or season three, but there's an episode where Dr. Melfi gets sexually assaulted in the parking lot of her office. And like the guy, like he beats her really bad. Like he beats her so bad, like she's using a cane to walk. She's got bruises all over her place. She is just roughed the fuck up. It's terrible. It's really hard to watch, actually. So when it happens, she goes into this restaurant and she recognizes that like the employee of the week was the fucking guy who sexually assaulted her. So obviously everybody at home is like, oh, bitch, she better tell Tony because you know Tony would fuck that guy up. And you can tell that she's having this debate in her mind. Like, there's the part of her that wants revenge and actually wants to, you know, tip Tony off, because like when he comes in for therapy after it happens and he's like, oh my God, like he's just so, you know, he does have, I think, a genuine affection for her. And she tells him it was a car accident. And everyone at home is like, eh, because we wanted to see that guy die. So that was like a big frustration, but they never bang. I think at some point he has like a sexual. So we get rid of the thing with him as being the narrator. And instead we start to get, like, Tony has these weird dreams. Like, some of them, they're usually dreams that are a manifestation of his subconscious. Like, Big Pussy, his pussy, ends up turning and ratting on him with the feds and wearing a wire. And he knows he needs to kill Pussy. And so he starts having these really weird dreams that are foreshadowing the fact that he's got to deal with Pussy. And so that happens pretty frequently. And he has one weird dream where he bangs her on the desk in her office and like his dick is like super large and his pants. It's really, the dreams are out there and they're super weird. a lot of people love the dream part of it. I personally don't like it because it's such a, it's a show that feels very grounded. And I feel like the dream stuff sort of takes it out of being so grounded in like reality and things that feel like accessible. So that's just my point of view on that.
But here's, so a couple of things. First, reacting immediately to what you just said. You know, we did have a dream in the pilot. And as soon as he said, and like a bird came and took my dick away.
Yes.
I shouted, it's the fucking ducks again.
Yes. Like, yes.
You know, that like his dreams are telling an additional story of what's going on in his head and the themes that we're, you know, grappling with throughout the episode. So I kind of dug the one dream that he had. I mean, as soon as he started talking about this dream, I thought he was going to say that he had a sexual dream about the two of them.
Right.
As like this attempt to, you know, put her on the back foot, make her feel awkward, assert some power in the conversation. So when he started talking about this screw in his belly button, I was like, what the fuck? And then there was a comment you made earlier on that I wanted to respond to, but it's been so long, I completely forgot now what it was that I wanted to say. Oh, no, it was a question. Now I remember the sociopath comment. So I'm confused by that because I thought sociopaths also showed complete indifference to animals, that like one of the earlier signs of a sociopath is whether or not they're cruel to animals.
Mm-hmm.
So him having a deep love for animals that supersedes his love for human beings confuses me as a sign of him being a sociopath.
There is a debate, I think, about whether or not he's a sociopath or a psychopath. And so she has like this dinner with all of her therapist friends. And they, that scene, I think, does it more justice than I could in terms of explaining how she comes to that conclusion. But like, it's her therapist is at the dinner with these other therapists and he just puts the shit all out on Front Street. And so then, of course, they like sit around and start unpacking it and trying to diagnose him and kind of start pushing back on her. Like, you know, how do you feel, Jennifer, about sort of playing a part in this? Are you really helping him? Because people like that are typically beyond help. So it's just very interesting, but totally agree. Because I remember an episode of Law and Order where they said this kid was a psychopath. I mean, a sociopath because he was like killing cats and stuff. But the show, I think, does a good sort of job at explaining why they land on that particular. I think it's the.
Are you sure he's not a psychopath? Because just a quick Google search, difference between a sociopath and a psychopath. Psychopaths tend to be more manipulative and can be seen by others as more charming, lead a semblance of a normal life, and minimize risk in criminal activities. Two out of three ain't bad, right?
Yeah.
And then sociopaths tend to be more erratic, rage-prone, and unable to lead as much of a normal life. I mean, I didn't get immediately hear, you know, talk about animals, but that's a quick and dirty of the difference. And a psychopath doesn't have a conscience.
They have a debate about whether he's a psychopath or a sociopath. The show deals with that. You just have to, I can't go, I don't remember everything in the conversation, but I genuinely did, because before this, I was like, it's a psychopath. And then I Googled it and I'm pretty sure that her call was that he was a sociopath, but there was a lot of discourse as to whether or not he was a sociopath or a psychopath. Like, and I think that a lot of people were sort of in having the same issues that you're having. Like, you can go on Reddit and see entire threads about he is not a sociopath. He's a psychopath. So I'm not telling you this because I think it's right. I'm telling you this as a spoiler, let you know where things go in the show. And, and it's interesting because the thing that's a breaking point for her is so stupid, but it's sort of emblematic of who he is. So he's in her. It's a lot of things. So he ends up dating one of her patients and like this woman has like a pattern of like picking the wrong man, picking abusive men. And the woman is, she needs a lot of, you know, psychological help. And that woman ends up like committing suicide after their relationship ends. Like he like roughs her up. It's a hot mess. But they both lied to Dr. Melfi about the fact that they were banging each other. So I think that was sort of where she began to start getting frustrated with him. But there's this episode where he's in her waiting room and he's looking at a magazine and there's a recipe that he wants. So he snatches the recipe out of the magazine, folds it up and puts it in his pocket. And she sees this and then goes into the session. And so during the session, she says, you know, those magazines are for everyone. And, you know, I would appreciate if they are left as is because other people are going to want to read them and you know, whatever. And so he completely lies about it and like denies that he did it. And that also kind of set her off, like, this is bullshit. And then like at the end, he finally like takes it out and unfolds it and, you know, makes this whole big dramatic scene of like giving it back. It's just, it's so stupid. But she just really, I'm not saying that that's what made her say, I'm not going to be your therapist anymore. But it was kind of the tipping point after a very long string of like frustration. So Carmela is the one who tells Livia about Tony being in therapy. I don't know why the fuck Carmela would ever do that. I feel like she was trying
Who's Olivia?
Livia, his mom.
Oh, okay.
So she's the one that tells Livia about him being in therapy. And I think in Carmela's mind, she was like trying to take a shot at Livia. Like you were such a fucked up mom that your son is now in therapy.
Oh, no.
So, of course, Livy then goes and tells fucking Uncle June. And that's how the whole thing gets out about Tony being in therapy. And so eventually, after Jackie April dies of cancer, there's an opening to be the boss of Northern New Jersey. And obviously, the two obvious choices are Uncle June and Tony. So there is a war where Uncle June's people try to take out Tony's people. And Tony's people end up winning. And the way that it's all like executed, it's very like Godfather christening scene, like where you're seeing these deaths all occurring just one after one. And I'm trying to think, at some point, I can't remember how or when, but Tony does finally realize that his mom is out to get him. Because one of the things that she does also, in addition to telling Uncle June about the therapy, is he eventually puts her in a nursing home. But then
in a nursing home or a retirement home?
A retirement home.
Okay, just want to be clear.
And so then he uses the retirement home. So then like his captains start putting their moms in the retirement home and they start using it as a place to meet and talk business behind Uncle June's back.
Oh,
and so,
my
of
God.
Course, Livia goes and tells Uncle Junior about this as well. So it's just one of many things. She sets those fires. She is the one that basically sets Uncle Junior on the course to take out Tony.
What a cunt.
Yes. Yes.
What?
Yes.
His own mom.
His own mom.
I mean, listen, my mom has told me, like, you can't trust anyone on this planet. But you kill somebody, you come and you tell me. You know what I mean? Like, your mom is supposed to have your back no matter what. Like, that's the one person on this planet you're supposed to be able, like, supposed to be your ride or die. Not die or die. Like, what the fuck, mom? Like, fucking hell.
Yes. Oh, his mama is brutal. I'm going to tell you a little bit more.
But do we get any flashbacks on, like, him growing up with her?
I want to talk about your thing about food as love. But let me take a backtrack because I want to close the loop on the conversation. She absolutely diagnosed him as a sociopath. And here's the list. I found like a very nifty little summary as to why she reached that conclusion. Lack of respect for the laws. That's obvious. The lying and deception. Mm-hmm. Yes. The impulse and lack of future planning. You may not see it in the pilot, but Tony is impulsive. I mean, it's an issue. That's why I'm like, this whole thing about being a sad clown and the Gary Cooper, it's just such bullshit because...
I mean, that car thing was pretty impulsive where, like, he had to react in the moment and be like, I'm going to take a car in public and, like, use it as a weapon.
Yes. And that's not the only one. Like, there's this like, politician who starts banging his grandmother after he breaks up with her. And he gets upset because she's dating him. And the episode where he finds out, he rolls up to this man's house. The ex-grandmother is there, breaks out a belt and starts whooping this man like he's a 2-year-old child. Like, and it's completely, like, it's just a pattern of impulsive behavior. So, yes. Then, obviously, it's the aggressive behavior, which you see it in the pilot. That doesn't get any better. He doesn't consider his own safety or the safety of others. That is a thing that comes up, like, particularly with Christopher's. So Christopher ends up getting engaged to this girl that's in the pilot for, like, 3 seconds. She plays the hostess at the restaurant at the inn.
So I know her.
Everyone knows Adriana.
Buffy.
Yes.
She's in Buffy. Yeah.
So everyone knows the story of, like, Christopher and Adriana. But there's a night where, like, the two of them are doing coke. And then they decide they want to do some more coke. So they get in his car under the influence and they're driving like more than an hour to find a coke connect and they flip the car. And then, of course, that turns into all of these rumors. They were like, yeah, her, she was sucking his dick. And then the car flipped over. And so then they had to put on this big showing for everyone to stop the gossip. So Tony, Carmela, Adriana, and Christopher, like, go out to dinner at Vesuvio's, the new Vesuvio's, as you know, that the first one got blown up to, like, quell the rumors. Fails to live up to responsibilities. And the other thing was the lack of remorse. And so touching on the lack of remorse, he obviously cheats on Carmela all the time, but Tony ends up killing Christopher and feels no remorse about it. And I'll just segue into the stuff about Christopher. So Christopher does end up writing his movie like he talked about, and it's called Cleaver. And I love the foreshadowing in the pilot because, you know, when he kills that guy, there's that big bloody cleaver, like, on, you know, that's really focused on. And so what's so funny is, like, everyone watches the movie when it comes out, and everyone is absolutely clear that Christopher has some deep, deep, deep resentment for Tony. And, like, Tony is completely oblivious to it. He's like, yeah, I had a good time. I love the movie. He didn't realize, like, that one of the main antagonists in the film was very obviously him. And so, like, Carmela's having to sit him down and, like, break it down for him. Like, yeah, you might want to watch out because Christopher has some unresolved issues. So Christopher ends up having to kill, well, he doesn't kill Adriana, but she ends up, like, getting caught up with the feds. And they try to turn her as an informant, and she decides to go into witness protection, and she begs Christopher to go with her. And it looks like he's thinking about doing it, and instead, he tells fucking Tony, and then Tony sends Sylvia to kill Adriana. So Christopher never really forgave Tony for that. He does end up getting married and having a kid with this other woman, and, like, he and Tony are out one night, and these girls are, like, driving erratically on the highway. Christopher goes to swerve. The big SUV tumbles over. Christopher is really hurt badly, like, you know, coughing up blood, wheezing. You can tell he can barely breathe. And then he tells Tony, Tony, you got to get me out. You have to, like, we have to switch seats. And Tony's like, why do we need to switch seats? And he's like, because I've been using. And Tony gets pissed. And then he literally pinches his nose and watches as Christopher basically chokes and drowns on his own blood. It is so gross and so gory. And he feels no remorse for it whatsoever. And when he tells Dr. Melfi about it, because everyone thinks, oh, he just died in a car accident. All he keeps talking about is how he looked in the back seat and he saw this big tree branch going through the car seat where Christopher's kid would have been sitting. And he was like, what if the kid had been in the car? He was concerned about this hypothetical situation with the kid and not the fact that his fucking cousin, like a man that he's treated like his son his entire life, is fucking dead and killed him. It's a hot mess. Like, it's just crazy. So let me go back to Livia. There is a point, and it's after Tony realizes that she's the one that's, like, gassing up Uncle June, where she has what appears to be a stroke, but it also might be her faking because she knows Tony knows and she's trying to get a reprieve. And he literally comes to the hospital and they're rolling her on the stretcher and people are like there. And he picks up a pillow and like he like is trying to fight the urge to not smother that bitch right there in front of fucking everyone. Unfortunately, that story doesn't really, it's great what you get, but the actress died at some point where they were filming. So then we go through this really weird phase where they're trying to like close the loop on her character. And so they use this like terrible CGI and these like bad, like discarded scenes from other episodes to like patch together a few final scenes. And then she dies on the television show. Her funeral is fucking hilarious because it's like all of these people are coming together and they're just like, oh, it's so sad. It's just, you know, like they're being sad. And finally, Carmela has one too many drinks and she's like, y'all are full of shit. That woman was awful. And all she did was bring us misery. She made her children miserable. It is one of those hilarious moments, as is Christopher's intervention. So I mentioned the intervention, and this is why Tony got mad at Christopher for using again, because his drug use gets really bad. They have this intervention with so it's like Tony, the poor intervention man, and like all of these, like Silvio, Polly, like all of these, you know, grown capos in his family are sitting around. Adriana is there. And you know, when you get to the point where like people are like airing their, like telling them like, oh, you did this thing to me and it was very upsetting. So at first, like Tony is really cool and he's like, you know, it is what it is. Like, I want him to get the help. He needs to get his shit together. But then Adriana, so you see it in the episode. So Christopher had gotten so high that he sat on her dog and broke its neck and killed it. And when Adriana shares that story at the fucking intervention, Tony loses his shit and starts beating the shit out of Christopher. And it just all like blows up into fisticuffs. And it's a really dark story, but it is so fucking funny. I've never laughed more than I have at his intervention because I'm like, y'all really got together and whooped his ass. And the poor like intervention specialist, it's like, no, 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 this isn't what we do. And meanwhile, it's just become like a festivist airing of grievances. Like the way you see Silvio in the pilot, but Silvio is one of the funniest characters. And he's like, yeah, one day we had to get together. We were supposed to meet to do this. And you were late because you were high. Pissed me off. It is so funny. Like just the, it, his intervention is hilarious. So, all right. I've walked through Livia, walked through the therapy, the food connection. So you know how you talked about how like food is love? So in the therapy sessions, Tony ends up realizing that the very first time he had a panic attack was when he was really young. And he was supposed to go to school that day, but he didn't go. And he ends up seeing his father kill this man. And like, he like cuts off the man's, like they're in a butcher shop. So he's like cutting off the man's fingers and like, I don't know, does he kill him? He either tortures him or kills him. But either way, it's like they make this whole showing of how like they're cutting off fingers and it's all bloody and gory. And somehow Livia knows what's happened because when they come home for dinner that night, he brought her this big roast from the man that he tortured and it, her pussy was wet. Like she was like, oh my God, you know, like, you know, you roughed him up and we got this roast. It's a or maybe it's like, I think it's a prime rib because prime ribs tend to be, they cook them really rare and it's all bloody and the way she's like cutting into it and she's just looking all sexual and looking like she's never been more attracted to her husband than she's ever been at that moment. And Tony sort of, you know, looks at this prime rib and he's thinking about this dude and he just passes out on the floor. So that was his very first panic attack. So yes, food is love, but for Tony, the food is triggering because I think the way they get to this revelation is he was eating some cold cuts in the refrigerator and he starts to have a moment and he mentions it to Dr. Melfi and she finally picks up on it and that's how they unpack it. So, all right, told you about Christopher, Melfi. Carmela does not bang the priest. She wants to. Then Tony goes to Italy and he gets this guy, Furio, who comes over with him to be one of his captains. And Furio is like a rough and tumble, like, I'm just going to beat your ass. But I told you, he's like really hot and really sexy. And so Carmela tries to be slick and she starts off like, oh, Furio, you've got this new house. Let me help you decorate it. Like, it's all like, let me help you get acclimated to the United States. But really, they're falling in love with each other. And it's so sad because I really, really wanted her to fuck him. And it gets so bad that, like, there's a scene where he contemplates killing Tony. Like, they're outside and there's this helicopter. And he, like, snatches him up. And you can see that he is tempted to just throw Tony into the blade so that it would just, I guess, chop his head off. But he doesn't do it. And I can't remember, like, what the events were that lead up to it. But long story short, he just ends up going back to Italy because he can't, you know, deal with loving her, not being with her. And then obviously the prospect of, like, you know, Tony finding out. So Tony and Carmela do separate eventually. And they have this really ugly fight. And the breaking point for him is when she tells him, I was in love with Furio right under your nose. Cause this dude would like come over every day to pick Tony up. She'd make him coffee. So they were really bonding and he loses his shit. Like, he never beats her or anything like that. But I do think he grips her up a little bit in that scene. So they do separate for a little bit, but they ultimately end up reconciling. And he does, in the beginning at least, stop cheating on her for a little bit, but he always goes back to it. He can't help it. It's who he is. Okay. On the topic of things not holding up. So there's this whole storyline about the fucking Johnny Cakes, about this captain in the family who is gay. And so Meadow at this point is in college. She goes to Columbia and she's dating this guy named Finn. And they're working at this construction site. And he shows up early one day for work and he sees the mafia dude blowing another dude in the parking lot. And then someone is at a gay club doing a pickup for the family. Like, you know, the extortion pickups they do for protection. And they see him. And girl, he is in there living his best life. He is like leather daddy, like out there just like jamming and stuff. And the guy sees him and he tries to play it off like, oh, I'm not gay. I'm just here because, you know, I'm looking into X, Y, and Z. And the guy's like, sure. So then the rumor starts spreading around because this guy's married. He's married to a woman. He's got a whole family and whatnot. And there's this whole debate about what they're going to do about him because he's a really high earner. But the reason why they end up going after him is because he is married to the sister of this New York captain named Phil Leotardo. And he's like, if you don't get rid of him and you don't kill him, it is going to completely erode your working relationship with New York. We're going to fucking shut you out. So that finally forces Tony's hand because I think he was inclined to let the guy stay on because, like I said, he was a top earner. So long story short, they do end up killing him. It is extremely, you don't see it, but Phil eventually talks about the things that they do to him. And it was horrifying. And his son ends up all fucked up because, of course, the kids have heard these rumors. And there's like this scene where his son is like in gym class and takes a shower afterwards and takes a shit in the shower because the kids are teasing him about his dad being gay. It was terrible, terrible, terrible. And I'm trying to think, what other spoilers did I have? Oh, I was going to talk about the finale, but you've seen the finale. So there's nothing else to talk about. So that's it. As always, guys, thanks for listening to this week's episode of I'm Gonna Need More Wine. If you haven't already, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and tell everyone you know to do the same. If you love us, leave us a 5-star review and tell a friend to subscribe. Christine, where can people find you on Beyonce's internet?
Y'all can find me at Kippins K on both Twitter and Instagram. What about you, Jocelyn?
Yep, you can find me on Twitter at Southern Belle, B as in boy, E-E-L-E, V-A as in Virginia. Instagram is not even worth your time. I'm private, but I do accept, you know, new people that want to follow me after a screening to be sure that you're not on any fuck shit on your timeline.
And y'all be sure to check out our very first episode of The Pilot Project, in which we discuss the pilot episode of The Walking Dead. We have also covered a number of iconic shows on the podcast, so please check out our episodes on Game of Thrones, Pose, Drag Race, Fleabag, Loki, Falcon and the Winter Soldier. They're all at morewinepod.buzzsprout.com or wherever you stream podcasts. And be sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at morewinepod. You could also email us with longer feedback and comments at morewinepod@gmail.com. Arrivederci, y'all.